It's Thursday, May 3rd, 2018. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Revolutions in morality, big changes in society, do not happen usually in an unbroken sequence of events. There are fits and starts. There are beginnings and there are middles and there are ends. One issue leads to another. One change allows another to take shape as possibility and eventually as actuality. When speaking, for example, of feminism and its influence in the culture, generally it's recognized there were two giant waves of feminism in the 20th century. The first came early in the century with demands for female suffrage, that is, for the right of women to vote. The second great wave of feminism came with figures such as Betty Friedan in the 1960s, 70s, and 80s, calling for what was then styled women's liberation. But that, too, now appears to be something of ancient history, with a third, perhaps even a fourth wave of feminism, especially as characterized by young women in the millennial generation. The Me Too movement and the background of an entire shift in sexual morality that includes not only a renegotiated set of relationships and expectations over sex between men and women, but the entire complex of those acronyms such as LGBT. But even these successive waves, these major movements in something like a symphony or a musical score of moral revolution, they, on the other hand, are not unrelated, and we need to understand those relationships. You can't have second-wave feminism without first-wave feminism, and as we shall see, that second-wave feminism came with the advocacy and with certain kinds of ideological commitments to issues that would have been anathema to first-wave feminists. Likewise, the third or fourth wave feminists, especially the millennial feminists, look at the world very different than their mothers and grandmothers, even if all of them identify as feminists. What we see right now on major college and university campuses with sex reduced to the single moral issue of consent, well, second wave feminists, those who are baby boomer feminists, feminists who came of age on the college campuses in the 60s and 70s and 80s, they see millennial feminists as hopelessly sexually afraid and repressed. On the other hand, the millennial feminists, if they do understand second-wave feminism, are often appalled by what they see as the false consciousness of those feminists in their involvement with sexual morality. To make the issue clear, second-wave feminism went hand-in-hand with the sexual revolution, that vast revolution that began to normalize sex outside of marriage, premarital sex, adultery, that began to celebrate sex as a human right, and the exercise of sex and the demonstration of sexuality as the ultimate utopian dream of what it means to be a person. But as K.S. Himowitz points out in a recent article for the Los Angeles Times and a far larger version of her article published in the spring 2018 edition of City Journal, those millennial feminists who like to listen to rock and roll and want to celebrate the liberation that came in the 60s of sex, drugs, and rock and roll may not realize that that feminism was very much tied to the very same developments. The feminism they reject was part and parcel of the popular culture they want to celebrate. Hemowitz's article in Sunday's edition of the New York Times was headlined, "Me Too Feminists May Not Realize It, But Their Other Target Is Sex and Drugs and Rock and Roll." Hemowitz very honestly goes back and traces developments such as the rise of the magazine Rolling Stone. And she points out that in the culture of Rolling Stone, a freewheeling sexuality ruled that was expressed in rampant sexual behavior, even amongst persons in the office associated with the magazine, both men and women. Hemowitz writes that the goings-on in the sexual revolution were certainly not driven by the sole morality of consent that seems to rule the millennial feminists, or at least many of them, in thinking about their own sexual revolution, the Me Too movement, and that morality of consent. Because, as she points out, the women of Rolling Stone magazine evidently were quite avid in their consent for very widespread sexual activity that by today's standards would be considered sexual harassment. She says that the 60s-style liberation of sexuality did indeed empower women. But she says, quote, "The sexual revolution also helped midwife the soaring number of single-parent families and the related ills of inequality, poverty, achievement gaps, and men missing in action from family life." And she says, "All these many years later, younger feminists are exposing new flaws in the sexual deregulation bequeathed to them by their elders," end quote. Now, that's really important. That's an example of drawing lines connecting the dots between different kinds of developments, linking second-wave feminism, tied to the sexual revolution, with the new millennial feminism, which is tied to a very different understanding of sex. But that new understanding of sex is by no means a return to some kind of sexual sanity. It is indeed driven by all that is left of the sexual revolution, a mere morality of consent. But as we see over and over again, consent simply isn't enough to constitute any kind of sexual morality that can undergird and protect human dignity. Himowitz points back to the 60s when there was the declaration that sex is feminist, and she points out that now, effectively, many millennial feminists are saying no sex is feminist, or any sex is feminist. But then again, at least second-wave feminists understood what a female was, whereas the millennial feminists and others who were involved in the new millennial moral culture seem to be absolutely committed, or they say they are committed, to the fact that there really is no standard definition of what it means to be male or female, and certainly not a definition that is tied organically to what's now identified as the gender assigned at birth. Looking back at the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s, Himowitz writes, quote, "The original sexual revolution stripped young women of the social support they need to successfully play gatekeeper, just as it deprived men of a positive vision or even a reason for self-restraint. Recognizing the legacy of those losses," she said, "is where any reformation has to start," end quote. Insightfully, in her essay, The Longer Version, published in the current edition of City Journal, Himowitz writes, quote, "Adding to the radicalism of the sexual revolution was its egalitarianism. The moral imperative to break free of society's repressive rules would benefit everyone, male and female." She's here expressing what was supposed to be the promise of the sexual revolution. But she says, quote, "Because so many of the old rules had involved the second sex, women revolutionaries assumed that they would be the major beneficiaries of the new permissiveness. The double standard and male dominance would wind up in the dustbin of patriarchal history, leaving women free to roar." But using language a bit more specific than I would use on the briefing, she points out that that promise was certainly not realized. There was no promise of an egalitarianism. Instead, the sexual revolution just reduced protections that historically had been in place for women and made virtually everyone more vulnerable. But that's really speaking about women, because it also unleashed male sexual behavior in such a way that you can certainly understand why the Me Too movement has arrived on the scene. To put it in another way, echoing a biblical cadence, it's as if the sexual revolutionaries of the 60s sowed the wind, and now we are seeing what happens when you reap the whirlwind. The most important explicit lesson drawn from Himowitz's essays is the fact that sexual revolutionaries offer very ambitious promises, but they failed to deliver on those promises. Most importantly, when you look at the coalescence between the second-wave feminists and the sexual revolutionaries, it was the feminists who claimed that the sexual revolution would inevitably lead to a utopian freedom of which women would be the primary beneficiaries. But it hasn't turned out that way. As Himowitz points out, just look at the social evidence. Just look at the women who are now being very clear that they have been sexually misused by men. Just look at the chaos in American college and university campuses. Just look at the breakdown of the family and the erosion of marriage. Just look at how many children and women have been abandoned by the men who decided they like very much the idea of a sexual revolution. It's those left behind that have to pay the price. But this is where Christians looking at an article like this, again, a very intelligent article offering very important and incisive insight, what we have to note is that what Himowitz refers to as the possibility of reformation is simply another form of secular thinking that won't lead to its promised end. There is not going to be any reformation of the sexual revolution in either or any of its dimensions unless there is a return to sexual sanity, and that means some kind of sexual morality based in human dignity and respect, which also means respect for the basic moral rules that God has not only indicated in His scriptural word, but has also given us in the very structures of creation. I can understand why a secular think tank, such as the Manhattan Institute, that does very good work, would have to end an argument with the kind of promise of reformation. But this is where Christians have to understand there are no tools for such a reformation. There is no equipment for such a reformation. in a secular society that is continually at war with sexual sanity. I really like the title of Himowitz's essay in City Journal, the title, "The Sexual Revolution's Angry Children." I can understand why the sexual revolution's children are so angry. Just imagine how injured, how hurt, and how confused the sexual revolution's grandchildren are sure to be. But then in another article that gets at some of the same issues, Sunday's edition of the New York Times included an opinion piece by Elizabeth Gumpert. She is an editor at the journal N+1. The title of her article, "Our Bodies, Ourselves, Our Anger." She writes about the fact that the feminist textbook, Our Bodies, Ourselves, now very famous as a part of the sexual revolution and second wave feminism, is going out of print. But as she writes, we should also note the fact that there were transformations in the text, Our Body, Ourselves, from its origins back in the sexual revolution. Gumpert is clearly upset that this famous feminist text is going out of print, but by the way, we can understand the reason why. There once was a time when this kind of text became very famous or infamous because it related to women information that many women said they did not know and did not have access to until the publication of the book. But now, all that information is widely available. Well, in one sense, it's all just a click away. Gumpert goes back to the year 1970 when the book first appeared. She wrote, quote, "Our Bodies, Ourselves was originally a booklet titled Women and Their Bodies, a Course, self-published in that year, 1970, by the Boston Women's Health Collective. The collective had grown out of a sexual health workshop at a women's liberation conference," she writes, "and the booklet the members published was forthright and, frankly, political." Just how political was it? She points out that the book began with a political statement even before it got to sex. And even as she says that it was frankly political, she went on to say that it was a political aspect that is, quote, "rarely invoked even by many progressive health organizations nowadays." But, she says, "for the authors of the early editions of Our Body, Ourselves, it was crucial. Political economy and the recognition that physical health is inseparable from it," she writes, "helped unlock these women's understanding of their social and political circumstances, their relationships to medical professionals, and ultimately their own bodies." Now, the point to make here is that all of this is something of a requiem and something of a reminiscence, something of a longing for what she saw as the political sexual revolution, the sexual liberation of women in that second wave feminism and in the sexual revolution of the 60s and 70s. Now, even as she's talking about the book going out of print now, she bemoans the fact that later editions were far less political, and she sees that as a tremendous loss. But the reason I'm talking about this on The Briefing today is because she begins the article with an extremely telling illustration. She writes, quote, "The second edition of Our Bodies, Ourselves, published in 1976 by Simon & Schuster." I'll just insert here, it went from being a self-published book offered by a feminist health collective to being published by one of America's most famous leading mainstream publishers, Simon & Schuster. But going back to her statement, she says that in 1976, the second edition, quote, "featured on page 229 something I'd never seen before, and I don't believe I've seen it anywhere else since. A photograph," she says, "of a woman having an abortion." She went on to say, "the caption, like the inclusion of the photograph itself, is matter-of-fact, informative, and free from sentiment." The quotation under the photograph was this, "vacuum suction abortion at Preterm Institute in Washington, D.C. Note," said the words under the photograph, "that the woman getting the abortion is wearing her street clothing," end quote. But here we need to connect yet another dot that connects second wave feminism and the sexual revolution, and that dot is the issue of abortion. The second wave feminists argued that abortion had to be the right recognized of women if indeed they were going to experience the sexual liberation they were promised in the sexual revolution. They declared that this, now just consider contemporary controversies over abortion and the language that's being used. They declared back then that abortion should be understood as a women's health issue. That's how they wanted to reframe it. And they wanted to make it so normal that, as this photograph chillingly demonstrated, the woman who was having an abortion, even back in that photograph published in 1976, was pictured in the photograph having the abortion with her street clothes on. The signal there was very clear. The moral signal was, there's nothing unusual here. This is absolutely normal. This is just what women dressed in business clothes do. They have abortions. Gumpert wrote, quote, I first came across this photo several years ago while doing research on radical feminist groups. Even in that context, it was arresting, perhaps because it was presented without fanfare. There was, she says, no sense that showing a woman having an abortion was, for a text on women's health, anything other than par for the course. When I learned recently that Our Bodies, Our Cells, now in its 9th edition, would no longer be updated after September, I thought immediately, she said, of this image and of the fact that it was not, after all, par for the course for any book, end quote. Well, there you see some of the frustration of the second wave feminists, the frustration that abortion, over against all the promises that the sexual revolution made and that appeared to be promises made by the U.S. Supreme Court in the Roe v. Wade decision in 1973, against all of those promises, abortion still today is not just par for the course. Now, we should be thankful for that. It is simply an indication that human dignity shines through in such a way that even the cult of abortion has not won what it had demanded, the normalization of abortion. And this explains why, for instance, on a recent edition of The Briefing, we talked about the new memoir by the soon-to-retire head of Planned Parenthood, Cecile Richards, in which she insists over and over and over again that abortion is simply a women's health issue. It's often called a women's reproductive health issue. But of course, the point of abortion is not to reproduce, but not to reproduce. So you see the anger of many of the third wave feminists on American college and university campuses today, and attendant with that anger is a very deep confusion, but anger shows up in the headline of this article from someone who is looking back wistfully to the second wave feminism, who writes, here's the title of the article again, Our Bodies, Ourselves, Our Anger, end quote. Connecting these dots and understanding what was promised ideologically in both second-wave feminism and the sexual revolution, you come to understand why so many women, and in particular so many advocates of abortion, argue that without abortion, women cannot and will not ever be sexually liberated. But of course, the promise is supposedly that if women did have unrestricted access to abortion, if abortion did just become par for the course, if it were to be morally normalized and simply accepted as an everyday act with no moral consequence, well, the fact is, of course, we know there would be no sexual liberation. The sexual revolution cannot deliver on its promises, and even more importantly, abortion cannot deliver on the promise of sexual liberation. All it would mean is the continued sacrifice of millions of unborn human babies at the altar of the promises of an idolatrous sexual revolution, a revolution that from the very beginning was destined to fail. As we try to think consistently with a Christian biblical worldview, one of the questions we have to ask is why are persons on the other side of the argument so absolutely insistent on abortion as an essential human right? It is because, and we simply have to understand this, they genuinely believe, or they have convinced themselves that they believe, that abortion means liberation. In order to get there, of course, they have to deny the personhood, the dignity, and the sanctity of the unborn life, and in order to get there, they have to go to the courts and to the legislatures and bring pressure and coercion. But this is where Christians, looking at an article like this that has anger in the headline, has to understand that behind this article, there is not only anger, there is an unspeakable, but quite understandable, sadness. But finally, also as we're thinking about worldview, there are some very interesting issues that arise from a recent article that appeared over the weekend at the Wall Street Journal. The author was Kevin D. Williamson, we should note, very interestingly involved in a controversy over his recent firing at The Atlantic. But in this piece, writing for the Wall Street Journal, we find the headline, quote, Republicans do well in Texas, except for Dallas, Houston, Austin, and so on. Williamson begins by saying that Republicans in Texas now face four big problems. What are those problems? Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin. He says this, Texas may be famous for wide open spaces, but the people and the economic output are increasingly concentrated in its major metropolitan areas. Of those four big cities at their heart, not one has a Republican mayor. Three have Democrats, and one, San Antonio, has a nominal independent who vibrates, Williamson writes, on Elizabeth Warren's progressive frequency. The biggest Texas city with a Republican governor at present is Fort Worth, but then Williamson gets to the even bigger picture. He writes, quote, of the nation's 20 biggest cities, one is in New York and four are in California, six are in Texas, El Paso has surpassed Boston and Washington, and San Antonio now has twice the population of Seattle, end quote. Now, my guess is that most Americans have no understanding of these numbers. that a city such as El Paso is bigger than Boston. El Paso's bigger than Washington, D.C. Furthermore, that San Antonio now has twice the population of Seattle. But the important thing that Williamson raises here is that there is a huge worldview distinction between rural America and urban America. We have seen repeatedly that once you get closer to an urban area, to one of the two coasts, or to a college campus, you are entering ever more secular terrain. And with that more secular terrain comes a more liberal worldview. The cultural worldview changes, the moral worldview changes, and this is no real surprise. This is true not only in the modern world, it was true in the ancient world. Just consider the New Testament and some of the letters, for example, by the Apostle Paul, written to some of the leading cities of Asia Minor at the time. Just consider some of the issues that Paul addresses to the churches in those urban centers. It was true then, it's true now. The liberal centers are far more given to a looser sexual morality. They are far more secular. They are far more resistant to traditional Christianity. Of course, Williamson's main concern is political. Republicans have counted on Texas being resolutely red, but it turns out that rural Texas is moving to urban Texas. And it's not just rural Texas moving to urban Texas, it's the rest of America moving to Texas. And as we're thinking about the congruence between geography and worldview, we need to note that there's a political congruence as well. The Democrats, as a party, largely have control over America's major cities. Williamson writes, quote, "Only a handful of major U.S. cities routinely elect Republican mayors. San Diego and Miami now lead that little pack. New York's Giuliani-Bloomberg run having played out, the simple fact is that Democrats have most major U.S. cities effectively locked up. Just consider this little fact," Williamson offers. "The last Republican mayor of Philadelphia was born in the year 1880. Applying worldview analysis, the big lesson here is not just about Texas. It's about the United States of America, and it's not only even about the USA. It's about the increasing urbanization of the entire globe. And with that urbanization comes not only the concentration of population, there also come the worldview distinctives of urbanization. And that urbanization often comes with a very clear moral and cultural change. But that cultural change comes with a political change, and that's why Kevin Williamson is offering this warning that Republicans, even in Texas, now have four big problems, and you can name those problems: Houston, Dallas, San Antonio, and Austin. But by the time you finish Williamson's article, it also becomes clear that those are not the only four big problems facing those who might be identified as political or moral conservatives, even in Texas. It's not just Houston and Dallas and San Antonio and Austin. It's a constellation of other cities also growing in Texas and growing more like other Texas cities, such as Dallas and Houston and San Antonio and Austin. But as we're thinking about moral revolution, successive waves of feminism, and successive chapters of sexual revolution, here's what we need to understand: that as America changes, it can even change where you see a big red space with even faster growing blue dots. Make no mistake, it's those blue dots that are increasingly, unquestionably driving the culture. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to my website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. Today, I'll be delivering the First Amendment address at the National Day of Prayer in Washington, D.C. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.